what else is going on? Like, why are...
Oh, my God. And even after telling Peace Corps a million times, like, oh, no, I don't think they're doing anything evil. I don't mean to say they're doing anything, like, fraudulent. No, definitely nothing, like, really bad like that. They've done a lot of good stuff. However, their behavior... pretty fucking sus. Pretty fucking sus, if you ask me. Kind of wonder what the fuck else is going on in that sussy baka environment.
Is the weird, the way, the content restrictions at all? Like, for me, again, this is...
She's being very vague now. Content restrictions. A pro-Israel, anti-Palestinian position was, like, mandated or something. And that's why a lot of the creators also responded with, like, hey, we've got, like, pro-Palestinian people on this. Like, I don't know where you're getting that idea from.
I'm Taylor Lorenz. I cover technology. I've been a tech reporter for like 15 years. I'm also a content creator, and I write about technology, the internet, and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, and my audience, I think a lot of them know you from various different interactions with either the Chorus creators or Ethan Klein and Hasan Pike or these kinds of individuals. But you report a lot on technology and issues that implicate the First Amendment too, and that I think is a shared interest of ours. Go ahead.
I cover tech policy, and I have covered tech policy for a little over 10 years. I for New York Times, Atlantic, Washington Post, et cetera. I still freelance a lot. But yes, I also cover the influencer economy. So I feel like if you're under the age of maybe 40 and you're involved in internet drama, that's probably where you see my face.
No worries. And though we might have some disagreements on some of those issues, I think people might cite, like, for example, the Chorus drama. I think we're very aligned on...
Wait, what's the disagreement?
I think we probably would disagree on the characterization of at least some of the contractual terms that came out in the Wired article. Yeah, and that has to
They should release their... They haven't been able to get a single correction on the story.
Well, listen, I'm in favor of full transparency. And we'll get to transparency and privacy, because I think
So not to interrupt, the Chorus thing is really crazy. Their reaction to me was so insane and made it such a story. Like, I think that there's a case...
Do you see how good she is? I'm not exaggerating when I say that she's probably in terms of I think Kelly Jean was one of the most kind of effortlessly manipulative people I've ever heard speak before. She is like the Kelly Jean. Like, do you see how many twists and turns she just fucking maneuvered Pisco through there? So I think we would agree on most stuff, the Chorus drama. Oh, what do you think we wouldn't agree on? Well, I think that maybe they, something. I was like, oh, well, maybe they should have released their contract so they'd have more transparency and they would have gotten a single correction issue on the story, right? Like, she's so good at just like, oh my goodness. Oh man. I wonder if Pisco's gonna, I don't know if he's aware of this or not.
Made if you're a political influencer to take dark money. I wouldn't do it, but I understand why they did. I just think you should be transparent about it.
Like the phrasing there. I wouldn't, rape anybody, but I guess I understand why you would, right? I wouldn't take dark money personally, she does, by the way. Like, she literally, the MADO or whatever the fuck that Qatari dude or whatever the fuck, like, she literally takes just as much, in kind of like a dark money thing as she was accusing Chorus of. But, it's funny that she claims otherwise.
Especially if you're going to call out Benny Johnson and Tim Pool for taking money under the table. I just think we need more.
Benny Johnson and Tim Pool were not taking money under the table. Oh my God! Dude, this is like the most densely lie-laden statement. Holy shit, she just said 30 crazy things in 2 seconds.
Transparency in our political system. It's not like a personal attack on it. I mean, I have friends that are in that program. I don't, it's not, no hate on that.
It wasn't a personal attack.
And stuff, and I report on, when the right does it, I report on it. And when the left does it, I report on it.
Well, if that's the extent of the normative position, in other words, where the dark money issue, it's not sort of the same kind of normative baggage that you would ascribe, fraud or something like that. That's not what you're alleging. And if the sort of larger prescription is disclosure, I think we're aligned on that. I do think that it's...
Yeah, that's what the story said. Nowhere are we accusing them of fraud. They definitely didn't. I mean, I think the people that orchestrated the program...
He shouldn't have used the term fraud as a criminal thing, more specific thing. And Taylor knows that. And now, is she really going to... I don't know. There's no way Pisco was largely in agreement with that or whatever, right? I don't remember. I know Straighterade Aaron had basically the most retarded takes possible, but she's a tanky. I kind of expected it. I feel like... Her and Pisco didn't agree on that, though, 100%. But I don't remember. I'd have to go back. But it's going to be really funny if she gets Pisco to agree with her general framing of that article by the end of this conversation. He wasn't agreeing. Was he? Was it because Aaron is being sneaky with her language? Or did Pisco really think that it was some, huge, massive, fuck-up, cover-up, horrible, disgusting, terrible thing?
Graham, the 1630 Fund lawyer, talking about skirting FTC regulations on the call is not a good look, but he didn't do anything illegal.
They were not talking about skirting FTC regulations. They were talking about the call. There's a statement where somebody said something along the lines of if we don't do this, or if we don't organize or assemble our thing in this way or whatever, then we don't have to report stuff to the FEC. That's just a statement of stuff. That's not what did she say? Skirting the rules. It's just following the rules. Right? I'm trying to think of even an example. If I don't pay myself a 401k in my business, then like I don't have to do like 401k matched compensations for like all of my, you know, W-2 employees and on my LLC or whatever. That's not like skirting the rules. That's just like stating what the requirements are. She's so sneaky. Ugh.
People, I mean, this is the problem in our political system is that we don't have transparency around funding. I want that across the board. I want that for like leftists don't get funding, but it's mostly the right that's doing this, right? It's mostly this is like 90% of this stuff happens on the right. So we should all want transparency.
And the one thing I have to take exception with before we get to the main meat of our topic, and I think though issues of transparency and disclosure are absolutely relevant and are you know percolating in a lot of the issues we're going to talk about, is the comparison to Tenet. Lauren, or Taylor, it's so different, right? I mean, like, the Tenet media, we're talking about...
Wait, what? Maybe he was thinking Lauren, because he's thinking Taylor Lorenz. That's okay.
Violations of Foreign Registration Act, evidence that...
I wouldn't compare the 1630 fund to Russia at all. Like, no.
But I mean, you kind of did, didn't you? Didn't you say that if he's going to call it Benny Johnson and Tim Pool, that he needs to make... Like, you kind of... That is kind of the comparison there, right? That you were implicating the Tenet scandal. That's kind of what you were talking about, no?
Oh, but I think in terms of... I'm just saying taking money from an entity where you don't know where the money's coming from. And by the way, that's what, you know, Benny Johnson and Tim Pool argued, right? Is that we didn't know where the money's coming from. We thought...
Oh, my God! She's a goddess, right? You see that she's like a goddess. She's so good at lying. Even in my conversation, it was an incredibly challenging conversation. The most manipulative person I've ever heard in the whole politicking world. I'm sure there are others out there maybe that I just don't hear in other sections of the media. She's so good at lying. She's so good at it. Oh my God. I got to slow it down. The LPM here, the lies per minute, is just so high. Okay, Jesus.
And that's what these, you know, look, that's how a dark money fund is structured. Compare the 1630 fund to Russia at all. Like, no, but I think in terms of, I'm just saying taking money from an entity where you don't know where the money's coming from. And by the way, that's what, you know, Benny Johnson and Tim Pool argued, right? Is that we didn't know where the money's coming from. We thought, and that's what these, you know, look, that's how a dark money fund is structured. You know,
no, I didn't know where the money is coming from. It was an illegal Russian operation that was explicitly funneling money to a media entity that was created to funnel illegal Russian money. It's completely different than we have a legally structured, is it a C4 or whatever, the hybrid entities where they don't have to disclose the people that donate to the fund. This is not even remotely in the same ballpark of things. Holy shit.
That you don't know where you're taking the money from. And what I would argue for these creators, I'm a journalist, so I do have to know where my money comes from. If you're a political...
That's a lie. Remember, she's part of... I don't know what it's called. Is it the Amedia Fund? Somebody can fucking link it, but that's not true. She takes money from these types of hybrid entities as well. I think... Did I ask her about that on our call? I don't remember if I asked her or not, but like, she does take this kind of money.
Well, influencer 1630 Fund has done a lot of good work on reproductive justice. They fund a lot of abortion campaigns. Like, I'm not saying there's some evil, you know, I don't support sort of the structure of dark money, but I'm not saying they've never done anything sort of good for the Democrats. But I think... We need to hold ourselves to higher standards, and we need to argue for transparency in the system, because if you buy into the system without transparency, the Democrats are not winning that system, you know? So that's all, really, I wanted to sort of get across.
On the disclosure front, I think we're totally aligned, and I do think that it's right. I had a debate appearance on Word War Debate. It's this new thing that I'm sure there's a bunch of like weird funding schemes. I don't know. They're like conservatives who want to promote debate as like UFC stuff.
I've seen this.
Did you see Anna Kasparian against Pearl Davis? It was like a complete blowout. So I was like the opener. We were talking about like I forget birthright citizenship, but yeah, I disclosed the honorarium they gave me because it probably is. There's I don't know what money is funding there, and I want my audience to know that I was being paid. That it was like a short notice that I went and did it. But no, I do agree with the disclosure aspect. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just saying like that was the crux of the article, and that's all the article. I think it got taken because of the insane way that they responded. It went off the rails. Like
no. It was because of the fuck, I wish I could remember that there was some explicit line that I remember hearing so many people run cover for when Lorenz was clearly implying something far more malicious than what was actually happening. I wish I could remember what it was. I think it was her claim that in their contract, they like explicitly forbade people from mentioning they worked for the fund. And then, but like the actual thing was like, if you're in a call with people, or like if you're on stream, maybe don't tell your audience what other people are in the fund, because they'll maybe arrest. It was like, the way that she expressed it was so much more insane than what the actual statement everybody that came out and said it was. Like, for her to just say like, oh, you know, they just responded crazily. Oh my God.
I still, to this day, it's very confusing to me. They knew about this story for a month. They knew everything in the story. There's stuff that we didn't end up including that was not great looking on them, you know, because we couldn't 100% confirm. They knew everything. I don't know why they didn't call up the Washington Post and say, hey, we have an exciting new funding program to announce, and just completely preempt our story. And so that does make me sort of question what else is going on? Like, why are...
Oh, my God! And even after telling Pisco a million times, like, oh, no, I don't think they're doing anything evil. I don't mean to say they're doing anything, like, fraudulent. No, definitely nothing, like, really bad like that. They've done a lot of good stuff. However, their behavior... pretty fucking sus. Pretty fucking sus, if you ask me. Kind of wonder what the fuck else is going on in that sussy baka environment.
Are they being so weird about it? But I don't know. It's just weird. Overall, I just hope that more of their followers of these influencers encourage them to be public. Because some of the influencers that I spoke to that were whistleblowing, essentially, that were like, hey, we want to disclose. But Brian Tyler Cohen or whoever's running this program won't let us.
That's a lie. Like, I don't think there's any proof of that.
That want to disclose.
Like,
you know?
Who said that?
Well, I think we're going to come back to this issue of disclosure and what could be some reasons for non-disclosure. Like I said, I think it'll rear its head in some of the conversations we're going to have about these laws.
Yeah.
But I will note... the kind of like vibes argument. I get good vibes from Brian Tyler Cohen. He seems like a nice guy. Maybe that's just my bias. And
personally, I have nothing personally against him. Nice. But he seemed to take this article in like a really weird way.
Weird.
And responded by posting a bunch of weird lies about me and
weird.
Attacking me personally and implying Tucker Carlson, who targeted me so relentlessly. There's like news articles about it. Is like my friend or something. Like it was really weird. And
weird.
He's implying that like I'm right wing when I'm further to the left than he is. So I was like, this is what I'm saying. It's just a really weird response. Because I've written so much about all of these weird funding schemes,
weird.
Including the weird stuff that the Democrats have done for a long time. So I just...
Weird.
I do wonder. But I'm sure personally, I mean, he's at events that I'm at. I don't think he's like an evil person. But I do wonder kind of why they're being so weird about disclosure.
Well, let's put a pin.
Courier is not. Anyway. But yeah, it is weird. So Courier, you know, funds creators and funds media people too. Courier is, what's her name? Tara... It's another, like, one of these big sort of Democrat, like, efforts to sort of change the media landscape.
Well, I'm not even
Democrats. They're huge. They're doing really well. And they're funding a lot of people. And they're doing amazing. But they're like, it's not controversial because they just let people that want to, you know, they let people say, I'm really excited. Courier gave me this money. I can finally cover, you know, all of the bad stuff happening in my town at the data center or whatever, you know. But
in general, so, you don't have beef with, of course, the idea of it. You want disclosure, but in general, you don't have a problem with, like, there being this kind of entity, even though it's something you personally might not do. Right.
I couldn't do it as a journalist. I couldn't write for the places
But if you were a Democratic, cheerleader, you wouldn't do that. Is that fair?
I would just have a lot of questions. I do think that those contracts were problematic, and every single ethics expert that we spoke to said that. And so I think, like, if I was going to sign on to a contract like that, I would have some revisions. But do I understand why?
Do not think so. She's so good at lying. She's the best. I really do mean it. I think she's one of the best. Somebody can post a separate from mine. I'm too lazy to go check. But when she says they had ethics people look into it and they all agreed. So I do believe they had one or two ethics people on that article make comments saying that like a thing would be really bad. But I don't believe that any of them had seen or commented on the contract directly. I think they were speaking more to the questions that she was presenting them. So it'd be like me saying like Dan and Mr. Mooten, by the way, I just got the anything else clause. Dan and Mr. Mooten have a clause where after the stream, they both scream the N-word 5 million times, by the way. And just so you know, in my article, I've got a guy who's the master of N-word passes and ethics from N-word University. And he says, if there was a show that was requiring people to scream the N-word after finishing the show, that would be insanely unethical if they hadn't purchased any N-word licenses first. And now that I have those two things, but I never showed him the contract. I just asked him the question about the thing. And then in the article, I asserted the thing actually happened. And then I could say, well, look, I even asked an ethics professor about this contract and he said it was unethical. Somebody can check, but I don't believe that the ethics person ever commented directly on the contract. I'm almost positive they were responding in general to the questions that were being asked. Somebody can go back and find that article and check. Didn't you say you rejected recently speaking with her? Yeah, she wanted to talk about this thing, and I just don't. Hell no. I don't agree with any of her takes related to online privacy or any of that shit. Even if we do agree, she's always coming from the most insane place where she'll be like, oh, like, I think that, like, censorship online is bad because Israel is trying, like, I don't want to protect. It'll be things that we're even, like, almost closely in agreement on. It'll be like, I don't think it's good to mass censor stuff by collecting IDs of people online, just to protect children, ostensibly to protect children from pornographic material, because I'm not even sure how effective that is, and there might be better ways to do it. And I'm like, okay, I agree with every single thing so far. And they're only doing all of this because Israel's trying to censor TikTok. It's like, wait, what the fuck? Wait, what? What? Like, she's way out on an island on most of these things.
Someone that is doing this work all day, talking about, you know what I mean, would take money, like, 100%, I'm not... I understand why they made that moral calculation. And I think we have to keep our criticism focused on the people.
I understand why they made that moral calculation. Jesus, nothing personal though. And I'm not making a judgment on them. I'm just being a journalist.
In charge of these operations and people like the 1630 fund, people that run these companies and say, hey, why aren't you mandating disclosure? Why aren't you filing these reports? You know what I mean? Instead of like attacking all the...
I'm sorry. I can't resist. What are the contractual provisions that you took most issue with?
The disclosure. It was a lot of the disclosure stuff.
So like what she's saying here about like you're not allowed to disclose that you're part of that fund or whatever. Not only did multiple people kind of say that wasn't true. I'm pretty sure there were multiple people that literally had publicly disclosed before. And I don't know what her response was to that.
Is the weird the way the content restrictions at all, like for me again, this is
she's being very vague now. Content restrictions, I believe she said, didn't she claim in the article that like a pro-Israel anti-Palestinian position was like mandated or something, and that's why a lot of the creators also responded with like, hey, we've got like pro-Palestinian people on this, like I don't know where you're getting that idea from. Oh my god.
Just like I think like there are people in that program that self-identify as journalists online, literally in their bio. And so I think if you're going to say that you're a journalist, you should abide by basic journalistic ethics. And there's stuff in that contract that is probably totally fine for a political influencer, but certainly not fine for an independent journalist.
What is, no offense, but what the fuck is the difference? What? I hate the term independent journalist. It's literally you walk around with a fucking phone and now you're an independent journalist. What do you mean by independent journalist? That's not like a protected term or a licensed term, or it doesn't fucking mean anything. Like, what do you mean? A political influencer, as much as it grosses me out to say it, a political influencer is just as much an independent journalist, probably more so than anybody else, and a guy walking around with a fucking cell phone.
And as an independent journalist, that's kind of like an issue that I would take if I was going to have to sort of sign on to that contract.
This is bringing to mind, I'm sorry to develop here, some problems I've had in sort of thinking about my own, like what I think is right when it comes to these like pundit sphere. So think about Midas Touch, right? Midas Touch, yeah. Unapologetically pro-democracy. That's their like tagline or whatever. Where in a sense, it's kind of like Democrat porn. Every other, image. And I like a lot of the content. Like a lot of the legal content is great. So, you know, I'm a lawyer and I cover a lot of the same stuff that Midas covers in terms of like legal cases against Trump and what have you. And so I like a lot of that content, but they are unapologetically biased in their coverage. So talk me through, since we're here, I guess, what do you think that there's a role for someone like me, someone like, other influencers who look at the news, comment on it, unapologetically biased in favor of Democrats.
I think that's good. Like, if you read my book, that's somewhere behind me, which you shouldn't have to subject yourself to. But, I started as a blogger. So, like, I started as a content creator just independently myself. I have no background in journalism when I got into it. So I am really actually generally a supporter of independent media and a supporter of people being open about their partisan beliefs. Because I've worked at all of these mainstream media outlets. And trust me, when I say those editorial decisions are being shaped by people's partisan beliefs every single day, but they're not transparent about it. And that's, I do appreciate the transparency that comes with a lot of new media. I think the thing that gets lost sometimes is the ethical stuff. I think if you are endeavoring to be a journalistic outlet, you should probably be a little bit more transparent. And even if you're not endeavoring to be journalistic, I think overall, like, a lot of the problems that we have around trust in the media today are because of the broad lack of transparency in our media.
Bullshit.
Climate. So yeah, I wish that these people would disclose their funders
people
and stuff.
Fucking
lie. But Midas Touch does whatever.
Also, your issue isn't that people disclose their funders. The issue is that people aren't disclosing the funders of the funders of the funders, right? Because a person could say, I'm part of the 538 fund or whatever the fuck, or the Chorus thing, right? Okay, so I get paid some money from Chorus, but not from every... that's not all their funding sources. Remember, they might say, I'm getting paid money from Chorus, but Chorus counts as dark money to her. But why? Because that's paid by the 538 fund. So wait, but then the 538 fund has a stated goal. You know that the 538 fund is what's funding the Chorus organization, and the Chorus organization has a goal. And you know that the pundits that the Chorus organization is funding have goals because they state their goals. So what you need to know, every single person that donates to the 538 fund, so that you can feel good about the Chorus fund, so that you can trust the influencers who get paid. Like, this is so fucking retarded. It's such a stupid fucking statement. Like, the level of transparency you're asking for can be... I feel like you could run this back. That's why I don't even like the term dark money anymore, because I don't know what the fuck people even mean when they said it. But you could play this game, like, with any funding mechanism ever. Like, anybody that I have, like, if I pay PSCO money, or for, like, Progressive Victory or whatever, if I'm, like, funding canvassing operations, do you have to know the source of every single person... Or do you need to know the name of every single person that's given me money in order to feel like I'm not dark money if I donate to a person? Like, it doesn't make any sense. It's just fucking retarded. These are the most redundant, They're just arbitrary and nonsense and vapid terms to use to attack people.
You know, they're whipping up the base and getting people to vote Democrat. Yeah. That's fine. You know, it's fine.
It's confounded, I think, sometimes also by government action and interference. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, especially this current administration.
Not the 530 fund, sorry, the 1630 fund.
Administration, where we have entire desks at the Pentagon or access when it comes to the White House press room being sort of given out as favors to ideological allies of the administration.
Yeah.
And where.
But Biden did that too.
You know, oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, 100%. I think that there's definitely a partisan slant to how some of these issues get dealt with by the government, et cetera. But there's also sometimes bipartisan efforts when it comes to speech-related issues, which is what we're here to...
It's all bipartisan. Yeah. That's the problem. There is no one in our government right now that sort of cares about speech and democracy. Yeah.
So why don't we get started then on the actual subject of what we're here to discuss? Because, frankly, I don't see like any people or major figures talking a lot about this. And the reason I reached out to you is because you're one of the consistent people talking about this. And so, if you don't mind, introduce what we're here to talk about and just from a general level so that the people in the audience can understand.
Yeah. So I basically what I want to talk about, which I go everywhere. I mean, Pisco, you're talking about no one talk. I went on InfoWars twice to try to get like, you know, the Patriots to even care. Yeah. Like, I will talk to anybody about this. I think as somebody that's covered tech policy and covered this extreme far right reactionary effort to mass surveil and censor the internet by dismantling Section 230 protections, by sort of passing censorship and surveillance laws under the guise of child safety. We're really closer than ever to what the tech policy agenda that organizations like the Heritage Foundation, NICOSI, formerly known as Morality and Media, laid out over a decade ago. And it's very scary. And you're seeing actually both the Democrats and Republicans go along with this. And I think that generally there are no leftists online that talk about tech policy. Like, if you look at the big leftist or even liberal influencers, they never talk about tech policy. And tech policy is so central to the right's power grab and has been so central to their rise. And the left has, like, completely dropped the ball and you cannot get them to engage. I don't know why they don't engage on these issues the way the right does. But, like, the right, like, the MAGA people, even if they disagree with you, they know, they're very, like, they know what Section 230 is. They will sort of, you know, spout their talking points. And people on the left, I think, just kind of ignore it. I don't know why, but it drives me insane. So now we're, you know, witnessing what happened today in the House and...
Yes, yeah, so what happened?
I saw AOC speaking against it. She was the only one. Against it.
No. By the way, when she says she's a tech reporter, that's like when programmers sort of call themselves software engineers. Okay, I don't think she reports on the substance of like any like tech or legal stuff. I haven't read much of her stuff, so maybe I'm being a little bit mean. But it's not like she is like a technologically astute or well informed person. And I don't think I've ever seen her make legally well informed arguments. She's more like a pop culture with a like in her flavor of pop culture is tech and internet. Culture, I would say that feels more like what I've seen her report on. Now she said 10 years, maybe in the past, maybe it was actually more substantive, but just from what I've seen, it seems to be the case that it's just kind of like pop culture-y, tech flavored stuff.
No, that's great, and I really I like AOC, and I like Senator Wyden, I think, as well in terms of the Senate.
Wyden's amazing.
Yeah,
he's amazing.
And so today there was a markup for COSA. Tell us what COSA is and tell us sort of the connection between COSA and other laws that are happening both in the country, in other states, but also internationally.
Yeah. So broadly, there's an effort to remove anonymity from the internet and transform the internet. Sorry, I'm in downtown LA if you hear sirens.
It's really low. The volume.
The goal is to transform the internet from a free and open place where we can all exchange ideas to a fully censored and surveilled internet where effectively the entire internet is like Netflix, where you can't. There is no user-generated content, period. Every single thing that appears online is hosted by an entity that takes legal responsibility and has pre-censored and pre-screened that content. That is the goal. It's a very authoritarian goal. The internet does function like this in extreme authoritarian countries. But that's how, you know, these groups have really mostly religious fundamentalist groups have wanted it since the 90s. Because they think the internet is a morally corrupting force.
And the group you're talking about there are like Heritage Foundation, people who are associated with Project 155.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. These far right, the Family Research Council, all these far right Christian fundamentalist organizations. Morality and Media played a really big role in this.
Sure. And consistently opposed by groups like the ACLU, I think FIRE as well, against COSA, basically organizations that argue for civil liberties. And how I can see it based on your reporting and what I'm looking at is the restrictions on the internet come prepackaged with certain sensible or understandable policy goals. And they take the form of, for example, regulations that purport to target speech on the basis of foreign espionage, foreign intrusion, national security, which is, you know, a very common refrain. And the other is to protect children and packaged as age verification.
Been the main thing. Yeah. The terrorism stuff like isn't really getting traction, I think, because people sort of saw what happened with like the Patriot Act and stuff.
Well, the TikTok ban. I mean, that one went through, of course, and that was premised.
It went through because there was no opposition. Yeah, there's no opposition.
And approved by the Supreme Court in 9-0 in a decision which cited the the fact of foreign threat, and assessed by both administrations. But yes, right now the push has been more for, because unfortunately there, even though ByteDance is not located in China, there is a foreign nexus here. But
the TikTok ban has nothing to do with this conversation. The Supreme Court ruling on this was very, very, very narrow. And the and like they said as much. I think they explicitly say it in the ruling. They're like, listen, whatever we say in here probably wouldn't apply to literally any other thing in the entire United States, but like, here's our ruling. I would never compare that TikTok ban. There are strong legal arguments and strong legal reasons why they probably shouldn't be allowed to legally operate the way that they were. That is totally outside of like these Section 230 protections or any free speech things.
That doesn't let always the government regulators target purely domestic sector, purely domestic actors.
They had nothing to do with, ultimately, it clearly wasn't any sort of threat, because they can get just as much data today as they could. It didn't come with any sort of data privacy like regulation. There's no effort to curb China's ability to access massive amounts of American data. It's so interesting though, because that argument, that national security argument, was
this is like the phrase, like, not even wrong, like she's just so out of whatever on this, but whatever.
Only made in the Supreme Court. It was not really what they were. If you watch the hearings about TikTok, it was all, it's digital fentanyl, it's giving your kids brain rot, there's these fake TikTok challenges. It was all around this moral panic around children, which is, it has been so effective. It's been so effective really for the past decade. But you're seeing it now. So you mentioned COSA. That is the acronym for the Kids Online Safety Act. Right now, today, the House Energy and Commerce Committee moved forward. Let me close this. Sorry, there's like a
no worries. No one can hear it, so you're good, but it might be distracting to you.
There's always some drama going on. So today, the House Energy and Commerce Committee moved forward a package of 12 bills, including COSA and a bunch of other similar bills to COSA. Essentially, all of them would strip anonymity from the internet, require age verification, aka identity verification, to use the web, under the name the Kids Act. It's like Kids Internet Digital Safety Act or something like that. And so that's been packaged together, and that moved forward today. And then in the House, in the Senate, you have COPPA 2.0.
Yep. Explain COPPA. The COPPA 1.0, and now explain what they're doing.
COPPA, not the COPPAs.
1.0 is this law from like back in the 90s that was aimed at protecting children online. This is when we had the Communications Decency Act. This was like, there was this big moral panic in the 90s about the internet's corrupting effect on kids. Kind of subsided for 20 years. Now it's back. But COPPA was this Child Online Protection Act that mostly was focused around like protecting kids' data, whatever. It's been sort of a messy
By the way, a decent chunk of the last few shooters probably were unironically just people that unfortunately got uber ultra fucking radicalized online, but I guess nobody really wants to talk about that.
Matic law, because it was written so long.
Like that, the Charlie Kirk shooter. I'm not aware of him being involved in any real life crazy fucking groups, but like apparently he spent a decent amount of time online. Now we haven't found the sites he was visiting. We don't have information of that, but like there's a 22 year old kid. The last trans shooter, I believe that person was. Their X account is still up. Talk about fucking terminally online lunatic. The trans shooter for the Catholic, that I think it was at a Catholic church that was like leaned in through the windows to shoot. That person was insanely terminally fucking online. This is a thing that happens. Now, don't make any mistake. I'm not saying that I think all of it should be censored and we need to get rid of all the freedoms and all that bullshit. But I'm just saying it's not like this is a ridiculous thing to worry about, like, oh my god, people getting radicalized online. Like, there's a strong argument you can make that Donald Trump was radicalized by what he saw online, and that's why he's such a fucking lunatic.
And it doesn't really, it's not great. So I'm not opposed to like efforts to amend it. It's just that they're amending it in insane ways, and they're trying to pass COPPA 2.0, which like actually erodes a lot of privacy protections. And also, the FCC said, it was the FCC that said they're not going to enforce COPPA anymore with age verification, or the FTC. I can't remember. One of the government basically is like, we're not even enforcing COPPA anymore.
I think it's the FTC. I think you're right.
FTC.
About.
Yeah. I'm always like, Brendan Carr just like constantly like tries to insert his hands in everything. So I'm like, are they involved as well? But yeah, it's so basically, you know, all of this stuff is also happening as there are escalating attacks on Section 230, which is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. It's what allows for user generated content online.
Yeah, no, it acts as a liability shield for certain, interactive computer service providers, which is defined very broadly to include things like even ISPs. But it was in response to a court case which extended liability, and which was like there was a big reaction from innovators.
It was two court cases of this sort of Prodigy and CompuServe, which were these old internet companies from the 90s, effectively before, you know, this was like when the internet was just coming about. And so they didn't really know how to regulate it. And they were sort of debating, like the far right Christian fundamentalists, they wanted a system where every single thing online was pre-screened and actually given a rating, like a movie style rating system.
I don't even know if she knows what Section 230 is or what the law is about or what is going on. Pisco obviously does because he's not fucking retarded. I don't know if she actually knows or if she just has like the propaganda points. The idea behind Section 230, I believe, I don't know, if I can check me if I'm wrong until I look up. But the idea behind Section 230 is that, let's say that I go to the Washington Post and there is an article and it says Stephen Bonnell is a pedophile. Okay. And I'm like, oh, well, that's not true. I'm going to sue the Washington Post. Fuck you. Like, you need to take this content down. Or let's say that you host a copyrighted image of mine and I see that you are hosting on your website. Well, I'm suing you. You're violating my copyright. Like, fuck you. Right. So for news websites or places where you have an editorial control over what goes on the website, that makes sense, right? Washington Post is the entity that decided to host that content. So in a way, they endorse it, and therefore they accept the responsibility of what goes on with it. However, you can see the huge cause for concern. What if I see the same thing, but it's on Twitter, right? Do I get to sue Twitter, or do I get to sue Facebook for user-submitted or user-generated content? Because if that's the case, that means anybody can submit anything they want to Twitter or Facebook or whatever else. And now Twitter and Facebook and all these other companies have massive liabilities to where they effectively kind of have to do kind of what she's saying, but she's like skipping a whole bunch of steps where you might have to have like huge screens for who's allowed to submit stuff or this is why when people say if you get rid of Section 230, it would abolish the internet, it kind of effectively destroys a lot of the social media user-submitted content, because now everybody that hosts the user-submitted content can theoretically be held legally liable, civilly liable for the actual content.
So every single website would be pre-screened by like government censors that would then give it like rated PG-13, rated R. Like, it was this absurd version of the internet. And instead, thank God, we created a different version of the internet, which allows for free speech and user-generated content. And so Section 230, effectively, because there is no public common spaces online, it's not like the physical world where we have the only spaces online are corporate spaces. So you have to, you have to allow those corporate spaces to do good faith moderation and allow them to moderate them. You know, that's that a BDSM forum is not moderated the same as a children's game or whatever. That's what Section 230 allows. Section 230, as I explain it, it is what allows you to speak freely online.
And of course, there's carve-outs for any sort of criminal or unprotected speech.
Yeah.
It doesn't include a carve-out for copyright, which is dealt with elsewhere in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
It doesn't mean you can say everything. Right, it just allows the concept of user-generated content to exist. So it makes it so that you can leave a negative review about a restaurant on Yelp, and Yelp won't take that down because they're legally liable for it.
Right. Because there is this notion in like sort of tort law that certain people who publish a message, even if they're not like the original ones who said the message or have that idea, might find some liability for certain kinds of courts. And so the idea is to use some of these
because explaining the actual law,
which really are the ISPs, are the platforms, these kinds of things, to prevent in the interest of the government or in the interest of litigants certain kinds of misconduct. So taking a big step back, we have a regime of legislation that's being proposed, some of it affecting pre-existing legislation like Section 230, other which is designed or at least purportedly designed to protect children, COSA specifically, with the age verification system, which is now...
Well, all of them have age verification. COSA is just the most famous one, but the App Store Accountability Act, which they're doing now, it's that sort of like their new answer is like, oh, we'll just have like, or if you look at Colorado or California, they're trying to enact, identity verification at the operating system level. They said every operating system, it's like the operating system on your refrigerator has to like verify your biometric data. It's all ridiculous.
And some are better or worse than others. Like, I note that the California one, even though I do not agree with it, and I don't agree that Newsom should have signed it.
She's not going to let this stand.
Any sort of government idea. It's just
that one, you're right. You could just be like, I'm 18 or whatever. It's just
so what's it doing? Right.
Well, what about the Hawaii one? Yeah. But I think it's the Hawaii one that says it doesn't. It's so obviously written like insanely. And it says, I believe someone tweeted the other day, some lawyer, that it says it's taking effect in 2077 so that they have time to deal with the like legal issues around it. It's like, so these lawmakers just want to pass something so they can get the local news headline that they passed it. But like this legislation is a mess. The state legislation. And also you have these activist states, Utah, Texas, et cetera, that are taking these really extreme approaches. And what they've done, the right, especially, but the left has done this with like, things like vehicle emission standards in California. Like, states always sort of try to like set federal policy by like passing these extreme laws. And so I understand the need for federal policy in this area. It's just that instead of passing federal privacy regulations and giving us actual like control over data privacy things that would actually limit the power of big tech and, you know, curb the power of these predatory platforms, we're getting the opposite. We're getting a mass surveillance and censorship, you know, system.
Taylor saying with respect to state setting federal policy, because oftentimes social media will be the least common denominator, sort of like most restrictive measures in a given state, they'll try to unify their regime, whatever that is, in terms of serving content or any kind of internal compliance or TOS, whatever, that effectively, if a state legislation, a significantly important state, has a particular system in place, because of economies of scale, because of trying to maintain a uniform policy, they might hew to the most restrictive standard. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Exactly, 100% right.
Yeah. And that's true internationally as well, as you noted in your articles, that
because GDPR that, and stuff,
well, not the same as the sort of the state federal distinction, having United States set a policy or the EU set a policy sometimes has effect even on how that policy is felt in the United States, given the global nature and reach of these social media companies.
Exactly.
Let's get to why these laws are harmful. So I'm gonna read the duty of care imposed by COSA. I think this is the May version. I know that there are amendments, and you tell me your preference with that. Quote, a covered platform, which is defined above, shall exercise reasonable care in the creation and implementation of any, quote, design feature to prevent and mitigate the following harms to minors where a reasonable and prudent person would agree that such harms were reasonably foreseeable by the covered platform and would agree that these design features is a contributing factor to such harms. Eating disorders, substance use disorders, suicidal behavior, depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, patterns of use that indicate compulsive usage, physical violence, and on and on and on and on.
Face.
What's wrong with that? We're just trying to prevent kids from getting hurt.
Oh, yeah. The Trump administration cares so much about children. I mean, what's wrong with that is that the lead co-sponsor of COSA, Marsha Blackburn, said this would be used to censor LGBTQ content. She said that we have to pass COSA to protect children from the transgender in society. You know, you have people like Jonathan Haidt, a main proponent of these bills, talking about how, you know, the internet is making these like liberal women more depressed and stuff, and kids might learn about liberal values and that could cause them depression. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, I'm all for pressuring these companies to moderate their platforms better and to, you know, serve less harmful content to people. I think the way to do that is to curb their power economically and to increase competition among platforms. We are not doing, I mean, there's so many actually options that we could do. This is just giving the government, basically allowing the government to deputize big tech to censor any content that they don't like. And you know what's so hilarious, Pisco? They're saying it out loud. Like, Pisco. It's not even like, oh, Taylor, do you think it could be used this way? They're like, we have to pass it so that we can use it this way. My favorite tweet ever about this was, actually about it, the Heritage Foundation published it. And this girl, Florence Ashley, I'm just going to read it to you.
Yeah.
This was like a year ago, goes, the Heritage Foundation openly states that they'll use bills purporting to protect kids to instead attack trans content, saying that it's posing a risk of social contagion, basically causing emotional harm among children. This is super concerning, especially given that the bills have bipartisan support. She tweets a screenshot of them saying this about the Kids Online Safety Act. The Heritage Foundation quote tweeted it and said, yes, we do. She's like, yay, they're going to use it. And they're like, yes. They quote, said, yes, we do, period. Keeping trans content away from children is protecting kids. So
That is concerning, as well as the fact that a lot of, not just these conservative groups, but unlike with the Section 230, where maybe some tech was behind putting in that liability shield, I'm sure a lot of them were, a lot of tech is behind these measures. As you know, in your articles, including Elon Musk, who has previously referred to transgenderism as a disease of the mind or something as well. I think Meta is open to this as well.
Meta is openly advocate. Meta has all these fake groups like the Digital Childhood Alliance, which just is this, like, there's all these slop groups that go online all day and post like
slop groups
down on big tech. We're moms and our little Johnny's addicted to social media. We need to crack down on big tech. How are we going to crack down on big tech? Oh, we just need mass AI surveillance.
Like, yeah, what? It's an insane, I think, overreach by the government to be proposed, and not just because it attacks communities or groups or affinity groups that are have low amounts of power or that are often repressed, though that is a concern, obviously. But the fact that it's vague and enforced either by big money litigants or, in the case of COSA, the FTC, under the control of whom, now under the unitary executive theory, Donald Trump. I want to remind all, like, liberals and left-wing people that Biden co-signed the TikTok bill. And I agree with the Supreme Court in terms of its decision, just from a legal perspective. But in terms of a policy decision, that was a whoopsie, because you gave implicitly the conservative follow-up, Trump, authority now to put in the hands of what, Larry Ellison? You're giving power to the government. And it is an absolute, I think, given the enormous amount of corruption that we've seen from the federal government, it's a slap in the face. You're shooting yourself in the foot.
I don't understand what Pisco means by that. The TikTok thing applied literally, explicitly, singularly to TikTok and ByteDance. But I don't know. Maybe there's something in there I miss.
To give them more authority. And so I want to stress, and I'll let you get in here, it's not just about these communities, though obviously we should be thinking about all of the harmful motivations that a lot of the people who are purveying the bill or supporting it have. It's the fact that it will be interpreted by a conservative judiciary, enforced by MAGA federal government, or big pocket litigants who are going to be suing other platforms who are going to be encouraged to censor. So go ahead and respond to that.
Literally everything you just said is 100% correct. And I want everybody to like really listen to those words and understand it and understand that I do not want the Democrats. I don't understand. I want the Democrats to win. I'm not a huge Democrat booster, as everyone that follows me knows, but like, obviously they're better than Republicans. Like, this is crazy. I don't know what the goal is other than that they also want like authoritarian control over speech. The thing that they don't realize, it's like, or maybe they do realize, I don't know. Like, I don't know why they're going along with this other than that they are so in the pocket of big tech themselves. And their whole thing is like, we're cracking down on big tech by, you know, passing these censorship and surveillance laws. And I think there's so much public support because the public is so brain rotted on this issue. Like, the public doesn't understand what's going on. So they're like, I love that Chuck Schumer is like protecting my kids. And it's like, well, Chuck Schumer is like, you know, about to give a multi-billion dollar win to Facebook and Peter Thiel. And so I guess, you know, that's what it is. It's like the Democrats can kind of appear to be like they're cracking down on big tech while also like rewarding big tech, which we know has been very beneficial for them. So I don't know. But ultimately, big tech is going to side with anybody that pursues that. Like, you know what I mean? They'll stand behind Trump in the inauguration. Like, it's just that. And also, I think people need to realize like who is being prosecuted. Like, you might think that you're you know, like a nice 45-year-old white woman in, you know, the middle of the country, and this is not going to affect you. Yes, it will. There was a woman that was, I think it was Virginia, who was arrested recently for being in an anti-ICE group chat. The New York Times reported last week that the government is sending hundreds of subpoenas, I think every week, to unmask people that are posting anti-ICE content online that are posting anonymously.
That was world news. That was world news. Yeah, that's been reported on. But yeah, go ahead, sir.
We see, yeah. So, but I'm just saying, like, we know how this is playing out. This is how it's currently being used, and you're advocating for more of it to protect children. Like, from what?
We'll talk about that. So I'm going to try to steel man the other side and say, well, let's put children's rights aside, because that's an absolutely good part of the conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Talk about is kids' rights. Let's assume that kids have either no First Amendment rights, which is not true under the current precedent of the Supreme Court. But we'll get into that. Okay. You say this, but all we'll have is just an age verification system. It'll just assess you.
Identity verification. No, identity verification.
All right, so now talk about that. So why is it not?
There is no such thing as age verification.
So talk about that.
So there is no such thing. Like, you know, this is just human biology. Like, there's no magical metamorphosis that you go through when you're, you know, the night before your birthday and the night after your birthday when you're turning 16 or 18 or whatever they want it. So there is no way to age verify someone without identity verification. You have to know who that person is. You have to know their birth date, and you have to confirm that that person is that offline identity. So, because again, there is no AI that can scan someone and
or human be able being to tell. Or human being. I just want to say that, like,
or human
I was a bartender and for like 4 or 5 years while I was studying for the LSAT and getting my law degree and stuff. And I'll tell you, I always carded people who I think looked a certain age, like under 30. And you would be surprised how many people that you assumed were obviously overage, how close they were to the age of majority or to 21, or how far away some people I thought were, you know, they're like 50 and I'm courting them. So it's not just an issue of computers and AI. Human beings at a distance can't often tell even a good range of how old somebody is. So yeah. 100%.
Also, just like you're trying to, you know, first they want to ban it to 16. The ultimate goal is 18. But it's, again, like a 17 and a half year old does not look meaningfully different. And the highest error rates for these systems are among teenagers, because they're all going through puberty at different times. And they're all like, you know, they're all at different stages. So you have to do identity verification. So age verification is an industry term from the identity verification industry, where they're trying to sort of correlate it to, like you said, like an age check at a bar. But it's like, but it's not like that. There is no offline equivalent to what they're trying to do. It's mass surveillance, where every single thing that you do, say, consume online will be tied to your offline identity in order to, again, protect, you know, the children.
And all being sort of housed within these private entities, which, as you report, have been subject to cyber attacks, leaks of information, and that kind of stuff. So talk a little bit about the Discord leak and how that plays into fears regarding who's going to hold this ID verification system, which is necessary in order to do real age verification if you don't want to do something ridiculous like what California is doing and what Gavin Newsom. Listen, I stand Gavin Newsom a lot of stuff, but I think it's cringe to sign vague legislation and like just hope it'll be amended later within your term. But yeah, so talk us about the threats to your identity information, which is necessary if you're going to have a real system with teeth.
Well, this is a massive data privacy. You're creating even more, like, the whole thing is that, like, these evil tech companies are harvesting children's data and using it for nefarious purposes to target them with harmful content and to give them, you know, lure them into gambling schemes online or target them to predators or whatever. Okay, so then why are you creating even more data on children? Why are you now allowing these tech companies to pre-comply and start harvesting biometric data on children, something they previously couldn't do? You're not even enforcing COPPA anymore. You're eroding children's, like, you're basically creating this market that incentivizes harvesting more and more data. And some people will be like, well, why not do it on the app store level? You know, and then Apple just has it. But the problem is Apple has to share that data with these companies, and you're still creating this massive honeypot. And now you have systems like in Arizona where people are having to scan their face and enter biometric data to look at their weather app, to open the calculator app, because the app store version of this is like 10 times more insane. And the iOS or the operating system, like all of this is just ridiculous. None of this is going to keep kids safe. Like that's what I think. The broader thing is like, these social media companies are bad actors. No one's arguing that they're great and that they're not, you know, trying to exploit like every ounce of everybody's attention. Nobody serious would argue that. If you want to actually like address the harms that these people claim that they want to address, then they're doing the exact opposite of that. So I just don't, you know, and not to mention the risks to children in terms of identity theft, in terms of blackmail. I mean, if you want to talk about, I was at the social media addiction trial thing, which is horrible.
What's that? Tell us about that.
There's a trial going on. Yeah, there's a trial going on in LA where this poor girl who was beaten and abused by her father, beaten and abused by her mother. The father left. She had an eating disorder. The mother used to weigh her every day. Her sister tried to kill herself. I mean, this girl has had a brutal life.
Jesus.
And they're arguing that actually it was Instagram that made her depressed. It's ridiculous. And it's a payout. And it's a lot of people just looking to get a payout. But it's so frustrating because it's like, you do see these kids that are struggling. You do see kids that are having a hard time. We could pass so many policies that could really help children. We know that significant amounts of kids in this country cannot even afford school lunch. I'm all for helping children have better lives and helping kids' mental health and all of this stuff. There's so many economic and social policies we could do that meaningfully improve that. Restricting their access to the internet is not proven to do that, and in fact, is proven to harm a massive amount of children. That doesn't mean that every child is using social media in a very healthy way. A lot of them are not. But we need to teach them responsible internet use. We need to give parents the power to, like you're mentioning, some kids like are very mature. They can handle it. Some kids are not. Some kids are going through a tough time. The parent might want to take the phone. Like, to have the government come in and do this, it doesn't address anything to do with it. It doesn't help any of the kids. And in fact, it endangers so many adults. Like you're saying, imagine kids don't have any rights. Okay, adults should have rights. And what about immigrants? What about people that can't upload their ID or whatever? You know, what about trans people in, was it Kansas, that just said their driver's licenses aren't valid overnight because they changed their gender? Suddenly they can't access the internet because they don't have an ID to upload. Like, this is a ridiculous...
And people understand that fear when it comes to the federal government and some of the posturing that Trump is doing with respect to nationalizing elections illegally.
Yes. Through
fiat. Yes. People understand some of those fears there. Maybe it's not intuitive when there's a middleman here, but understand that these social media companies, the leaders of the companies, are, you know, walking hand in hand with Trump. Some of these tech oligarchs, they're an operate like a sort of a wing of conservative or MAGA governance right now, 100%. Let's make some distinctions. So this isn't a brick and mortar.
What is that title? I found a Palestine coin that predates isn't real. Uh-oh. Don't ask him who minted that coin. Uh-oh, it's going to be even worse than Israel.
For deciding to have an age policy and enforcing it themselves. This is the government.
What do you mean? The designation of that area as Palestine, and then people that, sometimes people will point this out, they'll be like, oh, Golda Meir, these, you know, Israeli people had their original passports, and the coins that they traded said Palestine on them. Yes, they were minted by the British. That's when the British had the territory under control, and it was called the mandatory area of fucking Palestine or whatever, mandatory Palestine. But those were minted by the British, not by Arabs or the Palestinian people.
Saying you, if we're going to do the analogy, you store must have a age policy that's enforced via these means. So it would be like...
Not just age, before. Identity, right?
Identity,
so you're tracking everyone's identity. And then every single... So people will be like, well, I have to show an ID and go to the liquor store. Okay, fine. But that wine bottle doesn't just get tracked to you, and it doesn't... And there isn't data created every time you pour a glass of wine at your own house that you sip on it, that data is now going to follow you for the rest of your life. And by the way, it can be used against you in a court case 10 years from now. Like, I just want to say, we know. It's not even like we have to like guess on how these policies play out, because we know how they have played out in Indonesia, Malaysia, in China, in Russia, in Iran. We know how these policies play out and the way that they're used and the way that this surveillance system, you know, is abused, is that say you are going to a protest, or say you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, you step off the curb during a protest, right? That's not illegal in itself, but now we have DHS can scan your face, pull up your identity. Your identity.
You want a list? Did you see the clip of the one ICE agent?
Exactly. Yeah. No, literally. And then, but then now they also have all of your internet, everything that you have said, read, consumed, all of your chat histories, because text messaging, not text itself, SMS, but every other form of messaging app is also an internet enabled service. So they've got all your Signal chats, they've got all your WhatsApp chats, and they can go back and build a very compelling case to say, well, you're actually a terrorist. You stepped off that curb because you were looking to hurt someone. And here's the 20 hours of YouTube videos that you've watched of extremists. Here's a group chat that you were in where somebody said something extreme from 7 years ago. And they make these ridiculous cases against me. I mean, this is just what happens in authoritarian countries. And to see it happening in America, I know that sounds so stupid and like American centric of like, oh my God, I can't believe we're getting authoritarianism here. Like, that should be for Malaysia. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is like, these other countries around the world have passed similar laws, and we see how it's playing out, and we should not seek to replicate that here.
And let's talk a little bit about the state of the law. So in addition to the the Garland case, the Free Speech Coalition versus Garland. That was the TikTok unanimous decision. We had a decision which was less talked about earlier.
The Paxton?
Yes, this is Free Speech Coalition v. Paxton. And that gave the Supreme Court sign-off to these kinds of laws with respect to sexual pornography places online.
Why they're arguing the whole app store is pornography. Right. That's hilarious.
So just so people understand the legal aspect to it, the argument goes, well, this isn't directly regulating speech of adults. It's directly regulating unprotected speech, that is obscenity related to children, which is just flatly unprotected. And so this decision stands for, in those cases, when we're dealing with unprotected speech, the incidental burden to adults is something that's analyzed. It was actually analyzed under quote-unquote intermediate scrutiny, which is a level below strict scrutiny because the court is recognizing that there's a burden to adults. But it's all in service of legislation that's aimed at unprotected speech, obscenity as relates to minors. Here, we're talking about targeting speech that is protected. That is to say, news, apps that would look, for example, where you could get a news app, where you could get information related to healthcare, any kind of app that you can think of, first, depending on which regime that you're talking about, which specific legislation. And so the scope and sweep is much, much broader than what was approved in the Paxton decision. So I'll let you respond to that.
Yeah. And I, first of all, it was devastating to lose. Like you said, it wasn't talked about on the left. Certainly no one was really covering it, which is a bummer. And I think that's because people don't want to, they're weird about porn and they don't want to feel like they're defending like a child's right to see porn or something. Yeah. Like, and so there's all these like, and this is why you see this constantly. I mean, I was talking to Jessica Valenti, who's a great journalist that covers abortion stuff. She has the newsletter Abortion Every Day. And she was talking about how these obscenity laws are used to restrict obviously LGBTQ content, but also, reproductive health content, women's health content, et cetera. And especially under the Trump administration, we've seen them do this to, get books out of libraries and stuff about sexual health and all this stuff, arguing, obscenity. So it's disappointing that the Supreme Court sort of ruled that way. But as you said, there is that legal, I understand why that happened legally. There are questions as to whether any of this stuff that they're trying to do now is constitutional. But the problem is that we have an entire right-wing judiciary system, essentially, where all of these state legislatures and justice systems and stuff continue to side with, they just continue to sort of side with the most authoritarian. I think mostly because a lot of them are Trump appointees from the first Trump administration, who knows. But I don't know. You also had it's frustrating because even Justice Kagan during, I think it was the Gonzalez v. Google Section 230 case, did this press conference after where she's laughing and she's like, we're not exactly experts on the internet. So Congress should really start sorting this stuff out. And it was okay, you're not experts on the internet. That's actually a problem.
It's a huge problem. And it's not just on these laws.
Joke?
Yeah. No.
You're 100%. That's crazy. Oh, no. Sorry. I keep interrupting. But yeah.
No. I think it's a really important point.
Well, when Kagan said that, I don't know the context of her statement, but it sounds like she was saying this is really tough for judges to sort out every single type of internet dispute. It would be good to have Congress make rules here, because when you're Congress, you've got lobbyists, you've got staffers, you've got so many resources available to you that you could reach out to in order to craft legislation that is appropriate, that is nuanced, that is detailed, that explicitly addresses an issue in the way that you would hope the American public most wants it to. A judge is just kind of ruling based on what the law is, and the more vague it is, the more difficult it's going to be for a judge to make a determination, because they're not like the internet experts. That's what it sounded like. That would be my, if I had to guess what Kagan meant when she said that, that would be my guess.
And to stress, it's not just in the area of these kinds of laws. Think about the most recent fair use decision that was one of the most recent fair use decisions that was really important for copyright is the Google versus Oracle case. And there, they're assessing whether APIs are fair use under the factors. And it's our laws were, a lot of these most important laws, whether it's amendments to the copyright statute, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 230, were written in the 90s. And so we do need an update. We do need legislative updates, but they should happen, with a specific goal of from policymakers who are interested in maintaining this open form of discourse and having sensible law that's understandable by ancient judges, 80, 90-year-old judges. And I agree, it's not been a consistent win for free speech, unlike the religion clauses, which are very jealously guarded and sometimes even expansive by the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. giving ministerial exceptions to anyone who wants to claim to be a priest. The First Amendment has had less, I think, at least in my personal taste, protection from the Supreme Court. And look at these kinds of words that are going to need to be interpreted by courts. A design feature. What's a design feature?
Exactly.
Is it that it would make a harm reasonably foreseeable? A court's going to have to determine that in the course of litigation. And that, I'll finish this point and let you respond. Libs understand this. Left-wing people understand this in the context of the Don't Say Gay Act, right? Now, all the conservatives will say, come on, guys, the bill didn't literally say you're not allowed to say gay, but you understood that if you put litigation power in the hands of ideological big pocket litigants, that...
Okay, I'm bored.